invitation to Edith O'Vale. I am an urban guy with a rustic interior, and that perhaps explains the title of my first collection of poetry, which is called Rus in Urbe. As you probably know, that was the phrase used when they were coining the term for suburbs. The idea was to try and make people come out of the congested districts of the inner city and live in what was supposed to be the Shangri-La, the suburbs, the Rus being the little garden, and in Urbe, of course, the urban element. Of course, we know in hindsight a lot of the suburbs didn't work out quite as planned, and a lot of problems were created which were due to lack of planning and that sort of thing, and a lot of anonymity, and a lot of the community spirit of, say, inner city areas were lost when people moved out to the big sprawl. So that's the title of the Rus in Urbe, my collection. So the first half of the poems are rural, because I'm married to a lady from West Cork, and I wrote half the poems in the rural context, and also I live in Kildare a lot of the time, which is sort of in between rural and urban, if you like, because the rivers and the canals there. And then the urban part, of course, is going back to my origins, where I was born in the Liberties of Dublin. So if I may, I could read a few poems for you. The very first one, my very first memories of the Liberties. And this poem is called Ascending a Liberty Stairway in 1952. And I remember when this was first published in an English magazine, the editor asked me to write a few lines about the provenance of this poem, and this is what I wrote. I said, I was born in the Liberties of Dublin before it was desecrated, and was buttered and bred there in the 50s for the first 6 years of my life before migrating to the suburbs. Ascending a Liberty Stairway in 1952. The idea of the ascent hinges on the sense of the physical, which was so intrinsic a part of the way we lived in those days. There were no lifts. The sight of a mother, often slight and pale as my mother was, and the sheer physical exertion accepted unquestionably as part of the daily round, which was required to push a pram with a baby up many flights of stairs, is an image that lingers in my mind longer than any later suburban memory. We lived then in a pre-suburban, pre-Celtic Tiger, pre-high-tech world, where undoubtedly there was want and hardship, but also a great sense of community and wonder. So this is a poem called Ascending a Liberty Stairway in 1952. Slate grey steps with white ribbed bone to steady the foot, with the marks of the washerwoman's knees and the black garden snake to hold on to as it coiled its way upwards, polished smooth from the caress of hands, and the concrete landing where we stopped to catch our breath and a glimpse of the stars, to a rectangular opening in an ash grey wall which to its side housed a handled steel door, a chute to the great bin at the bottom of the stairs, locked in a room of its very own, where it could overflow to its heart's content and still take more, the extractor of the Liberty's ills. And the automatic light suddenly quenched itself on the landing. We were overstaying our time, watching the stars twinkle. And my baby sister cried from the darkness as we continued our ascent. I helped my mother tilt and lift. I could hear her heavy breathing, each slow, tortuous step, its own individual, our very own little Calvary. The baby cried again. Push now, we're nearly there, Alana, said Mam, but we were only halfway up with the pram. The second poem I'd like to read for you is a poem about secularism and faith, and it was set on the route to Santiago de Compostela, and there's just one word perhaps in it called the Voto Fumero, which I perhaps should explain is the giant censer that's used in the cathedral in Santiago for the incense during benediction. And this poem is called The Miracle of the Rain. The Miracle of the Rain. I undertake the peregrination out of secular curiosity. My companion Teresa, on the other hand, is saintly. I met her on the road to Santiago. She is frail, and her hair is a shiny silver. She walks discalced, suffering calluses and cuts smilingly. Her face is mystical, belonging to a sublime world. I walk beside her in my sturdy walking boots on the road to Santiago. She carries the pilgrim's staff and wears the scallop shell. Of course it's only a legend, I say, this thing about St. James being carried on a shell. It's a matter of fate, she says. You must believe things to be true, or the world is just a place of pain. It was when the hermit Pelayo saw the great light, and her own face lights up. We must get there before July 25th, El Dia del Santo, El Dia de tu Santo, Jaime. Names are fortuitous things, I say. And this year, 1999, she says, ignoring me, is the Año Santo. Todo Santo, I say, mocking her. The pilgrimage grows tiresome and difficult. But Teresa, she carries the smile all through the long journey. My feet are killing me, I say, and I'm sunburned. That is the problem with Spain, too much sun. You must not complain, she says, and her feet are bleeding. The peregrinación is the life. It's like life. We must keep going. We will be judged on how well we travel. We arrive at the city of Santiago on July 25th. We have made it, she shouts with joy, prostrating herself on the cobble square in front of the cathedral, delighting in the drizzle that has begun to fall. A miracle, she says, trying to grasp the drops, the miracle of the rain. And I see the strange sight, people in Spain walking under a black sky of umbrellas. We enter the cathedral, dwarfed like ants under its enormity. A ceremony is taking place. Several tourifers raise the giant Botafumeiro with ropes. People clap, and cameras flash from the darkness. That's not religion, I say. It's just a spectacle. And why do they need it so large? To fumigate all the unclean, she says. Does the size of church paraphernalia enhance religious depth? Be quiet, James, she whispers, and wait and pray for the miracle. What miracle, I say? The rain has stopped, someone whispers from the back. She looks at me, no longer cheerful, her face contorted, showing pain now, that was hidden all along, and copious tears flow out of her eyes, as if she had gathered up all the rain of Santiago. She presses her pilgrim staff, and I see the skeleton of her hand. Pray to Santiago, she says, that he may cure me. And I move closer to her in the pew, and we both kneel down. The peregrination, of course, for me was from the Liberties to the suburbs. In my case, Walthamstown, at the age of six. And the suburbs, I don't think it did it for me, really. Lots of good things, of course, in the suburbs, but lots of problems as well, and particularly problems for what I perhaps would call identity. And I tried to capture some of those things in a poem called Suburbia's New Day. Suburbia's New Day. The drone of an engine on the hill and morning percussion on my front door. Old Mr. McGimbley, unshaven and dazed, knocking to ask the name of the day. The chestnut trees had their day. Their candles are out, a refuge gone. Just stumps now, like teeth in a gaping void. They said they were too old. They scratched the bus. They thwarted the growth of houses and things. Sitting on the pavement, a girl sings, while two boys hit ball with her cripple props. And young Freddy in his garden caresses a machine, polishes the shining metal, does not hear the snarl up, or see the dead squirrel on the road. Miss Little and Miss Brown carry their load in plastic bags as they shuffle along the path. They hold each other like walking sticks, receding from the palpable into their own dark. I register faces in the park. You know me, my eyes say to a young fellow. We belong to the same classification. but the fellow sways, like legless on the grass, exploring in latitudes and longitudes. His shoulder grazes me as I pass, and I see them behind glass. They have a desk and a swivel chair. Their breaths are megabytes. Their trees are figures on the VDU. Their hearts are bouncing playballs, and they squint myopically, the seers of the new day. The suburbs, of course, brings its own class divisions, and you can see it, of course, when you live the north side. I don't know if you have in Cork or not. The south side, inner city, and so on, all sorts of class divisions. And it is coupled with the recession that's happening now. I see it as sinister. Certain things are sinister in the class divisions. The rich getting richer, the poor getting poorer. And a little poem that prompted that thought was, Why is the Future Sinister? A short poem I have here, again, dealing with suburbs. And it's called Why is the Future Sinister? The tramp stands with snowflaked eyebrows outside the frosted window, holding a knife and a cut slice of bread, while George dances to Boogaloo and Beverly swings her hips. Swishing blades rotate as more revelers land on the helipad, heads stooped in their frippery, marking their territory with Yves Saint Laurent. The tramp takes fright from his breast spy hole, just a boy with a world-worn face, bounding over the lawn, stabbing the air with his knife. The area I moved to then was Kildare, County Kildare, and I enjoy walking, particularly along the Royal Canal, which runs through Kildare, and the train runs beside it. And one of the poems I wrote, which brought my childhood back to me, was a poem called Old Trains, while walking along the Royal Canal. Old Trains. I'm walking by reeds to the gentle accompaniment of bird song and duck flapping on the still water of the Royal Canal when I hear the train. And childhood catches in my throat, sensing a visitor to stir the ennui of an innocent age. My aunt, her bag laden with crunchies, comics and stories to intoxicate mid-starved minds. The steam belching, the momentary obliteration, doors opening, chrome handles snapping shut, and as the steam clears, the apparition of my aunt waving. The new train stops at the station, its sound muted, no banging of doors, just a sliding swish, the waiting, but no one gets off. The train pulls away like a fooled animal, no steam along the sleepers, no choo-chooing, no rolling stock, just a flutter of breeze, a heart-rending absence, the path shimmering along the reeds. The second half of my poems, as I say, are rural-based, and I was a city guy arriving in West Cork. I suppose I could describe it a little bit like, I don't know if you ever saw a film called Midnight Cowboy, when John Voight arrived up from the country and Dustin Hoffman was going to show him the city ways. Well, I felt the opposite. I felt, instead of being the city slick, I was the guy that was being led into the guiles of West Cork, and I was rather the innocent, believe it or not. To give you some idea of that, perhaps I could read a few poems. Like the first thing that struck me when I arrived in West Cork, I remember, was the farmyard. And this is the impression I formed of the farmyard when I arrived. Farmyard. A little sea of mud and puddle. Wellington's squelch and dog's dirty paws paint OM letters in city coats. And smells that overpower perfumes of city people rarefied by their own milieu. The other thing I remember to show, perhaps my innocence, was I remember a farmer arrived in the house and he had this big pincers. And I was really curious to know what the hell they had this big pincers for. Huge thing. I never saw anything like it before. And I wasn't wrong in finding out what it was. It's called pincers. The giant pincers, a heavy instrument of sheer steel, shining, surgical, and yet too large for mortal use. A tool from Brobdingnag, incongruous between the pudgy fingers and dirty nails of the rough-hewn farmer. Perhaps its purpose was to prune the giant trees or the wild bushes that lurk about. "It's for the bulls," he said, handing it to me. I felt the weight of lives weighing me down. In the pure light, the pincers was pristine. Flashing apocalyptic, I opened its fangs and saw the black hairs. The one common thread between, of course, the urban and the rural is loneliness, and particularly unmarried people. And there's a lot of them in the urban setting, just as there are equally in the rural setting. And my next poem is called "The Bachelor Who Drank Putching." The Bachelor Who Drank Putching. You sang your sad song into the night with no applause from the mountain. Friends came after years to your house on the height. They beat back the briars and called out your name, Jeremiah, but your voice could not be heard. They pushed in the door, inhaled the putrefied air. They called again, and a bird flew out and alighted on a holly bush, and your corpse was found beside four empty bottles. Where we set up in West Cork, we often go down to the sea, and a little poem I wrote, which was prompted by that one of those visits, you know, whether it's in your Bantry or further afield, a little poem called Subtraction. And it's about doing sums in one way, but it's also about other things too. Subtraction. Ivy dying on a pier, stone crumbling, the skeleton of a boat sinking into sand. I carry the sum all through the years. Shadows subtracting from sunlit walls. A child digging a hole, taking away something deeper than himself. I wrote some poems in Irish, and one little poem I wrote I dedicated to a certain lady called Margaret or Mairead, and this is the poem that I wrote. It's called Umla Ella. Do Mairead. Eistim lati coirus sa chan changa, spekli urtanish le gila she tranona. Eg lunru lasar gorum de huila, tatu e kufrumu naguntus, on te praticuil den animus, con un dien a chamad dengen, is tosa untina satinta, is misha untishka e gultimpo, animus anima un kufrum baitu. And in English, the other half for Margaret. I hear you adding in the old language, wearing spectacles now, the soft light capturing in their frames the azure of your eyes. You are doing the accounts to keep the roof firm, the path clear. You are the fire in the hearth, I am water running through. Animus, anima, the balance achieved. One other poem that I wrote in Irish originally, I was prompted by a Kerry friend. He died there not too long ago, but he used to play tennis with me, and we were coming back from a tennis match along the canal. I was driving, and coming along the canal, I was turning up the Kildare Road. And he said, "What are you doing that for? You know, we go on a bit further and take the motorway, we'll be home much faster." And I knew what he said was logical, that absolutely made sense. but I knew there was something wrong. I wanted to answer him the question. And this is the answer I made to him, and it's called Ghost Road. In Irish, it's called Bohar na Daivshi. Bohar na Daivshi. Tashtilim Bohar na Daivshi. Da dogfa on motor valak, quickfa on valyanis luiha. Tashtilim Bohar na Daivshi. Da gosfa on shop, on rudder dertu, tashi laikui. Is far clistitu. Kepuntu nak vas and frevaka, ak fein cre tuha. Och tarringi and bohr na daivshi name or strang on imlakain. Ta on kli eleni skura, ta tu ikur ama amu. Och darire tomis avalia hanafe, bohr na daivshi. On chok bon shin ar clay, ta taisha mashana bohr siga. Och zum furgen of taif here doing, a vegan a hepe o tra, poso mahishmahori on shin. Och as vishid in the goni sa chakos ar gore, on night in ar gaul mishu. Ar bóthar na daibh sí. Tá lána ar dhéise chuir deire le na himantacht agus bula a bharan ann de bhéalta na beo. Agus ag an drosróthar thall féach an Winking Willie a bhfuil i bhíneod seom na colla am oncle agus é ag casa tóna nicta ar cósa na cadéisecha. Tá brón orra más tú a bhuiú a charaf a dhéfer a cadtá le sunrú ar an mótar bhealach nua Ni raun nach ui tarmac it sheen again. And in English, I should, I don't know if you had the Winking Willie down in Cork City, but in Dublin, the Winking Willie was a precursor of the traffic lights. Mm. And it was a big light that used to wink, and it was suspended by wires at crossroads, which was to warn people approaching the roads. So, Ghost Road. I travel the road of ghosts. If you took the motorway, you'd be home faster. I travel the road of ghosts. It's such a roundabout way, but what you say is logical. You are an intelligent man, but still I travel the road of ghosts. It's the pull of the umbilical cord. But really, the other way is shorter. If you turned off here and turned right there, you'd be home in no time. But I have plenty of time. Besides, I'm already home on the road of ghosts. That white house on the left we just passed contains the ghost of my grandmother. And that building back further was once a church of St. Bernadette, where my parents were wed. And in the house across they lived, perhaps where I was conceived, on the road of ghosts. The cross is where the Winking Willie used to wink, into the bedroom of my uncle's house. He stuck his bare bum out that window once. And some inquisitive neighbours. But the Winking Willie caught him in the act on the road of ghosts. There's a turn up above where my childhood ended, just off the road of ghosts. Like sticks to like, I smell their presence converging on the road of ghosts. You asked me to take the motorway, but the motorway has buried all its ghosts under tarmac grave. Thank you very much. Thank you.